Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start right up with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the great things in the wonderful world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up from WGBH, in opioid trial, pharmaceutical executive John Kapoor sentenced to 5.5 years. Former billionaire and pharmaceutical executive John Kapoor was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison. His sentencing is a culmination of a months-long criminal trial in Boston's Mukley Federal Court that resulted in the first successful prosecution of pharmaceutical executives tied to the opioid epidemic. Kapoor did not make a statement after his sentencing. The 76-year-old is founder of Incest Therapeutics, which made and aggressively marketed a potent opioid painkiller. Kapoor and four other executives were found guilty of orchestrating a criminal conspiracy to bribe doctors to prescribe their medication, including to patients who did not need it, and then lying to insurance companies to make sure the costly medication was covered. Two other executives pleaded guilty and became cooperating witnesses. Kapoor's 66-month prison term is substantially less than the 15-year sentence recommended by federal prosecutors, but it's more than the 1 year requested by Kapoor's defense attorneys, who maintained his innocence and stressed his old age as reason for a short prison sentence. The other executives received between 1 year and 33 months, significantly less than many of the prison times recommended by the federal prosecutors. For the federal government, this was a landmark trial in which corporate executives were charged under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, a charge often reserved for mob bosses and drug lords. Experts saw the trial as sending a message to drug companies that they will be held criminally accountable for their alleged role in fueling the opioid crisis. "I think this is just the tip of the iceberg," said Brad Bailey, a former federal prosecutor and current defense attorney who is not involved in the Incest trial but has been following it closely. "It's a template that prosecutors will continue to use." While seven Incest executives were awaiting sentencing, the company entered into an agreement with the government to settle criminal and civil investigations. Incest agreed to pay $225 million and admitted to the kickback scheme. Shortly after the agreement was announced, the company filed for bankruptcy. Amit Sarpatari, an epidemiologist and lawyer at Harvard University's Program on Regulation, Therapeutics, and Law, said he thinks this trial will have a chilling effect on the pharmaceutical industry. "It's an important warning to other pharmaceutical manufacturers and executives who may be considered pushing their products through aggressive and possibly legally dubious marketing schemes. The consequences for such actions may not simply be fines, which has historically simply been the cost of doing business, but possibly jail time." Well, my friends, it is long overdue and about time that pharmaceutical corporate executives are seen and treated as mob bosses and drug lords. Okay, next up from Safe Roads, 2020 Roadmap of Highway Safety Laws. Annual report finds most states lack crucial highway safety laws. Time for action by state legislatures. Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety Advocates. today released the annual roadmap of state highway safety laws, finding 395 proven countermeasures which could be saving lives that have not been enacted. The report, A 2020 Vision for Safety, provides a report card on 16 traffic safety laws for each state in Washington, D.C. Opportunity exists in every state to enact laws that combat the widely acknowledged public health crisis of motor vehicle crashes. With the start of a new decade, our clear vision is to eradicate the horrific death and injury toll occurring on our roadways. Every day, approximately 100 people are killed and nearly 7,500 more are injured in motor vehicle crashes. The emotional devastation inflicted on families from crashes also comes with a significant annual economic cost of $242 billion. This results in each person living in the United States essentially paying a crash tax of $784 every year. The status quo is unacceptable. As state legislatures around the country convene, now is the time for attention, activism, and action. The Advocates Report gives every state in Washington, D.C. a rating in five categories: occupant protection, child passenger safety, teen driving, impaired driving, and distracted driving, as well as an overall grade of green, which is good, yellow, caution, and red, which is danger. Seven states in Washington, D.C. received green ratings. 31 others received a yellow rating, indicating a need for improvement. 12 states earned a red rating for lagging dangerously behind the adoption of advocates' recommended laws. And lo and behold, this includes Ohio. There are many opportunities in this new decade for improvement. Primary enforcement seatbelt laws. 16 states lack an optimal primary enforcement seatbelt law for front seat passengers, while 31 states need an optimal primary enforcement seatbelt law for rear seat passengers. An all-rider motorcycle helmet law. 31 states need an optimal all-rider motorcycle helmet law. Rear-facing through age 2. 35 states in D.C. are missing a rear-facing through age 2 child protection law. Booster seats. 34 states and D.C. need an optimal booster seat law. Graduated driver licensing for teen drivers. 193 graduated driver licensing laws need to be adopted to ensure the safety of novice drivers. No state has all six optimal provisions of a graduated driver licensing law. Impaired driving. 30 important impaired driving laws covering all offender, ignition interlocks, child endangerment, and open containers are needed. All-driver text messaging restriction. 5 states still need an optimal all-driver texting ban. And graduated driver licensing cell phone restriction. 19 states need a graduated driver's license cell phone restriction. Okay, from food politics, let's switch gear. Let's talk about some food and nutrition. From Marion Nestle, the author of Food Politics. If it weren't so tragic, we could all have a big laugh at the USDA's latest announcement of how it plans to weaken the nutrition standards for school meals. Here's how it starts. And warning to the listener, you are about to hear a lot of corporate tease doublespeak. Here goes. From their press release. Delivering on this promise to act on feedback from dietary professionals, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue announced two proposals today that will put local school and summer food service operators back in the driver's seat of their programs because they know their children best. Under the school meals proposed rule, school nutrition professionals have more flexibility to serve appetizing and healthy meals that appeal to their students' preferences and subsequently reduce food waste. These improvements, built on the 2018 reforms that preserve strong nutrition standards while providing schools the additional flexibilities they need to best serve American students. Okay, back to the blog. This is USDA doublespeak. My translation? Dietary professionals. USDA is not talking about me here. It is referring to the School Nutrition Association, which represents school food service workers and receives nearly half its funding from food companies that sell products to schools. Driver's seat? This is Trump's USDA saying that it is not bound by anything accomplished by Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. Flexibility? This means that schools can decide on their own to ignore nutrition standards and let kids eat all the junk food they want. Improvements? This refers to benefits for the companies that sell junk foods in schools. 2018 reforms? In USDA speak, reform usually means rollbacks of rules or budget cuts. It never means real improvement. I just can't get my head around why there's so much political pressure to feed junk food to kids. Doesn't everyone want kids to be healthy? Apparently not. The Center for Science in the Public Interest interprets USDA's proposals as a, quote, an assault on school meals. In an email, a reader who wishes to remain anonymous sent me some notes on the large body of research, some of it from the agency itself, countering USDA's claims that the current nutrition standards are not working. USDA's own research shows that meals are healthier, plate waste has not increased, and most schools are complying with nutrition standards. Healthy eating research shows that the nutritional quality of school meals has improved under the current rules. A study from the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity shows that low-income kids are eating better under the existing standards. Surveys from Bridging the Gap show that most kids like the healthier school lunches. A poll conducted by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Pew Charitable Trust, and the American Heart Association shows that more than 70% of parents support healthier school nutrition standards, and more than 90% want fruits or vegetables served with every meal. A Harvard study estimates that the current nutrition standards will prevent more than 2 million cases of childhood obesity and save nearly $800 million in health care costs over 10 years. In short, school meals are not broken and do not need fixing. This is about politics. In this case, USDA is pandering to food company interests at the expense of kids' health. Shameful. Okay, sticking with that theme, from the Center for Health Journalism, new study debunks argument for weakening healthy school lunch rules. That healthier eating is good for kids seems self-evident. Yet a 2010 federal law spearheaded by Michelle Obama to upgrade school meal standards for the first time since the 1960s set off a partisan furor. Under the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, schools had to offer more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains and cut back on salt and calories, longtime goals of public health advocates, to say nothing of many parents. But critics on the right blasted the legislation as nanny state overreach. They said it would jack up costs, drive students away from school meal programs, and result in massive waste. Because what kid would willingly eat a banana or pizza with low-fat cheese and whole wheat crust? The House Freedom Caucus listed the act as number one on its list of 288 regulations it wanted President Trump to kill in his first 100 days in office. So it was no surprise when U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced he was relaxing the standards. If kids aren't eating the food and it's ending up in the trash, they aren't getting any nutrition, thus undermining the intent of the program, he said in a 2017 press release, promising, quote, to make school meals great again. The USDA asserted that so much food wound up getting dumped that some schools used it for compost. The rollback took effect last February. Now, a growing body of research, including the first national study of the impact of the Obama reforms published today, points to their success and debunks the rationale for weakening them. The latest study is part of a comprehensive analysis commissioned by USDA, which found the reforms did not increase food waste. That's consistent with earlier local research. Nor did the reforms drive up costs. What did increase when schools served healthier food? Nutritional quality of the school breakfast and lunches, student consumption of whole grains and vegetables, and participation in the National School Lunch Program. Exactly what the act was designed to achieve. Take that, Sonny Perdue. Okay, next up from Science Daily. Sepsis associated with 1 in 5 global deaths, double previous estimate. Twice as many people as previously believed are dying of sepsis worldwide, according to analysis published in The Lancet. Among them are disproportionately high number of children in poor areas. Led by researchers at the University of Pittsburgh and the University of Washington Schools of Medicine, the study revealed 48.9 million global cases of sepsis in 2017 and 11 million deaths, representing 1 in 5 deaths worldwide. Sepsis occurs when a person's organs cease to function properly as a result of an out-of-control immune response to infection. Even if sepsis doesn't kill its victims, it can create lifelong disabilities in survivors. The large majority of sepsis cases, 85% in 2017, occurred in low or middle-income countries. By age, the incidence of sepsis peaks in early childhood, with more than 40% of all cases occurring in children under 5. If you look at any top 10 lists of death globally, sepsis is not listed because it hasn't been counted. Previous global estimates for sepsis were limited as they relied upon hospital databases from a select group of middle and high-income countries. The previous estimates overlooked the substantial burden of sepsis that occurs outside of the hospital, especially in low-income countries. This study's findings are unprecedented as they represent mortality both in and out of the hospital. The most common underlying cause of sepsis-related death is lower respiratory infection. So, what is the solution? Well, to start with, it's basic public health infrastructure. Vaccines, making sure everyone has access to a toilet and clean drinking water. Adequate nutrition for children and maternal health care would address a lot of these cases. But sepsis is still a problem here in the U.S., where it is the number one killer of hospital patients. Everyone can reduce their odds of developing it by getting the flu shot and the pneumonia vaccine where appropriate. Beyond that, we need to do a better job preventing hospital-acquired infections and chronic diseases like diabetes that make people more susceptible to infections. Okay, moving on to health care for all. This from Physicians for a National Health Program. This is a short full-page ad that they put in the New York Times, signed by over 2,000 physicians, including many prominent physicians. As physicians, we prescribe Medicare for all. We are doctors from across the spectrum of our profession. We serve patients rich and poor, in hospitals and clinics, private offices, and public agencies. We witness daily the inhumanity and irrationality of the current healthcare system. America funds healthcare more generously than any other nation, and our hospitals and medical workforce are second to none. Yet despite an abundance of medical resources, care is too often meager. For the 30 million who remain uninsured, and millions more whose insurance is inadequate to their needs, life-saving treatment is often out of reach, deepening health disparities. Oppressive costs and fear of financial ruin amplify the suffering of illness. Meanwhile, doctors and nurses struggle to provide good care in a bad system. We waste countless hours complying with arcane billing requirements and, along with our patients, imploring insurers to fulfill their promises of coverage. It is time to transform the way we pay for care, to embrace improved Medicare for All. Medicare for All would curb soaring drug prices and dismantle the wasteful bureaucracy of private insurance companies, freeing up hundreds of billions of dollars to expand and improve care, while ensuring free choice of doctor and hospital. Vested interests who profit from the current broken system raise false alarms of dislocation and disruption to incite fear of change. They are wrong. Improved Medicare for All would bring welcome relief to patients, lower costs for families and communities, and allow doctors and nurses to focus on what matters most, caring for our patients. Okay, definitely sticking with this theme. This from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in an editorial accompanying a position statement by the American College of Physicians that includes an endorsement for single-payer health reform. The American College of Physicians' endorsement of single-payer reform, a sea change for the medical profession. For a century, most U.S. medical organizations opposed national health insurance. The endorsement by the American College of Physicians of single-payer reform marks a sea change from this unfortunate tradition. Like their U.S. counterparts in an earlier era, many Canadian physicians feared and fiercely opposed single-payer reform. We were afraid it would destroy the profession, that our integrity would be destroyed, that the government would intrude on the private doctor-patient relationship, said E.W. Barotes, who as president of Saskatchewan's Medical Association led a three-week doctor strike in 1962 against that province's new single-payer program. Yet, despite a rocky start, most Canadians now embrace their single-payer system. Everyone is covered, and all doctors and hospitals are in-network. Health costs, almost identical to U.S. levels in the 1960s, are now about 40% lower, with savings on administration accounting for half the difference. Although funding for some aspects of care has, in our view, been squeezed too tightly in Canada, physicians' incomes have not. Canada's health outcomes surpass those of the United States, including for such conditions as cystic fibrosis, end-stage renal disease, and type 1 diabetes, whose outcomes reflect quality of care. Canada's generally positive experience is among the strands of evidence underpinning the American College of Physicians endorsement. A single-payer reform that reduced insurance overhead to 2%, the level of Canada and traditional Medicare in the U.S., could save more than $200 billion annually. In addition, our multi-payer system imposes complexity and expense on providers. The Cleveland Clinic has 210 million different prices. Let me just say that again. The Cleveland Clinic has 210 million different prices. Single source payment could streamline reimbursement, for example, by replacing per patient hospital payment with global budgets and establishing uniform billing and documentation requirements. Hospitals and doctors could save billions on billing related costs and repurpose those savings to expand care, making universal first dollar coverage affordable. 3 decades after leading the Saskatchewan strike, Dr. Barotes had changed his views. Today, I support the universal healthcare program. There has been no interference in the decision making between a doctor and his patient. A politician is more likely to get away with canceling Christmas than he is with canceling Canada's health insurance program. Okay, that's the big picture. I'd like to drill down on one of the many, many, many perverse incentives that is built into the structure of our so-called system of healthcare in the U.S. here. This from The Hill: how non-compete clauses shackle physicians and hurt patients. Tardive regulation and the headache of dealing with third-party payers. Increasingly, more physicians are leaving private practices to join hospital networks. But rather than being a respite from the swamp of bureaucracy, these new employers are acting like roach motels with the liberal and coercive use of non-compete clauses in employment contracts. Physicians suffer, and so do patients. Non-compete clauses dictate where and when a former employee can work after leaving a place of employment. They are often non-negotiable and binding, even if a job is eliminated with no cause. In healthcare, non-compete clauses are especially egregious because they slow down innovation, disrupt the relationship between doctor and patient, and remove doctors who are already in short supply from the workforce. Non-compete clauses also interfere with a doctor-patient relationship. When a doctor leaves a practice, patients are left in the dark. Practices won't tell patients where they can find their doctor, and doctors can't say where they're going. The value of continuity of care is well documented. When patients build trust with a doctor, they tend to pay closer attention to their health, which in the long run reduces costs. The nation can ill afford to have doctors not working while they wait out non-compete clauses, which can sometimes last more than a year. When this happens, a new employer pays a physician not to work. These costs are passed on to all consumers in terms of higher healthcare bills.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay. Well, and now for something completely different. This is an amazing article in that it comes from the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, this year, or I should say last year, in 2019, a huge coalition of medical and public health organizations came together, as reported on this show, to declare that climate change is a worldwide public health crisis. This article deals with that, and the fact that it's published in a medical journal, which probably could not have happened almost unforeseeable five years ago, is truly amazing. So this, from the New England Journal of Medicine, the false promise of natural gas. Production of natural gas has grown by nearly 400% in the United States since 1950, and gas is now the country's second largest energy source. The main driver of this increase has been the wide-scale adoption of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. During the fracking process, large volumes of water, sand, and chemicals are injected deep underground at high pressure to fracture shale deposits and sand and coal beds to release trapped gas. The world's largest gas transmission network, with more than 300,000 miles of interstate and interstate transmission pipelines, 2.1 million miles of local distribution lines, and more than 1,000 compressor stations, brings this gas to the market. The ready availability of gas has reduced dependence on coal and oil, enables the United States to ship gas overseas, and will make the country a net energy exporter by 2020. It has also made gas an important feedstock for the chemical, pesticide, and plastics manufacturing industries. Natural gas, principally composed of methane, has been hailed as a clean, quote, transition fuel, a bridge from the coal and oil of the past to the clean energy future sources of the future. This claim is partially true. Gas combustion produces only negligible quantities of sulfur dioxide, mercury, and particulates. It is thus less polluting than combustion of coal or oil, and this benefits health. Gas combustion also generates less carbon dioxide per unit of energy than combustion of coal or oil. But beneath this rosy narrative lies a more complex story. Gas is associated with health and environmental hazards and reduced social welfare at every stage of its life cycle. Fracking is linked with contamination of ground and surface water, air pollution, noise and light pollution, radiation releases, ecosystem damage, and earthquakes. Transmission and storage of gas results in fires and explosions. The pipeline network is aging, inadequately maintained, and infrequently inspected. One or more pipeline explosions occur every year in the United States. In September 2018, a series of pipeline explosions in the Merrimack Valley of Massachusetts caused more than 80 fires and explosions, damaged 131 homes, forced the evacuation of 30,000 people, injured 25 people, including two firefighters, and killed an 18-year-old boy. Gas compressor stations emit toxic and carcinogenic chemicals such as benzene, 1,3-butadiene, and formaldehyde. Wells, pipelines, and compressor stations are disproportionately located in low-income, minority, and marginalized communities where they may leak gas, generate noise, endanger health, and contribute to environmental injustice while producing no local benefits. Gas combustion generates oxides of nitrogen that increase asthma risk and aggravate chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Compounding these hazards are the grave dangers that gas extraction and use pose to the global climate. Gas is a much more powerful driver of climate change than is generally recognized. As much as 4% of all gas produced by fracking is lost to leakage, and these releases appear to have contributed to recent sharp increases in atmospheric methane. Methane is a potent contributor to global warming, with the heat-trapping potential 30 times greater than that of carbon dioxide over a 100-year span and 85 times greater over a 20-year span. Gas burned in stoves and boilers additionally contributes to global warming by generating carbon dioxide. Together, this evidence suggests that the purported advantage of gas over coal and oil has been greatly overstated. Despite growing recognition of the dangers associated with gas and recent exponential increases in the production of electricity from renewables, new gas wells continue to be drilled and new pipelines built. The U.S. Energy Information Administration projects that that daily natural gas production in the United States will increase by 10 billion cubic feet in the next year, and that under current federal policy, more electricity will be generated from gas than from renewables each year from now through 2050. This expansion of the gas infrastructure is supported by government subsidies and tax breaks that benefit the fossil fuel industry and artificially depress gas prices. In 2016, federal subsidies for gas equaled $32.6 billion, an amount 60 times greater than the $533 million allocated to research and development related to solar energy. State subsidies provide additional support for fossil fuels. As physicians deeply concerned about climate change and pollution and their consequences, we consider expansion of the natural gas infrastructure to be a grave hazard to human health. All reasonable analyses indicate that we must leave nearly all remaining fossil fuels in the ground if we are to hold the extent of global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the target set by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and thus mitigate the health and environmental consequences of climate change. A further argument against investment in gas is that it is economically reckless. Such investment ignores the reality that the cost of producing electricity from renewables is falling rapidly, and that energy prices are approaching a tipping point, after which it will become cheaper to generate electricity from solar and wind sources than from gas. The Energy Information Administration estimates that by 2023, it will cost $36.60 per megawatt hour to produce electricity from wind and $37.60 to produce solar energy versus $40.20 to produce energy from gas. Any investment in gas is thus at risk of failing to yield an economic return and becoming a stranded asset. This risk could increase if federal subsidies for gas were to be cut. We believe the investment in gas is also short-sighted. States that provide subsidies for gas and permit construction of new pipelines and compressor stations will lock in dependence on gas for years to come while missing opportunities to invest in renewables. The real problem with fracking, then, is that it perpetuates a carbon-based energy system and delays the transition to a carbon-free economy. To address this problem, we recommend that state and federal subsidies for natural gas be reduced over the next 2 years and then eliminated. The International Monetary Fund has made similar recommendations. We also recommend that new residential or commercial gas hookups not be permitted, new gas appliances be removed from the market, further gas exploration on federal lands be banned, and all new or planned construction of gas infrastructure be halted. We believe an ill-conceived proposal announced recently by the Environmental Protection Agency to roll back limits on methane pollution needs to be blocked. At the same time, we call for the creation of new tax structures, subsidies, and incentives, such as carbon pricing that favor wind, solar power, and other non-polluting renewable energy sources, and policies that support energy conservation, clean vehicles, and expansion of public transit. Implementation of these recommendations will require courageous political leadership and face fierce resistance, but wide-scale transition to renewables would yield enormous benefit for the United States. It would reduce air pollution and therefore prevent disease, extend life expectancy, and reduce healthcare costs. It would free up the billions of public dollars now spent on fossil fuel subsidies, and it would protect our planet. Models exist for effective climate change. In July 2019, New York State enacted comprehensive energy and climate legislation and pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 85% by 2050. To meet this target, New York is developing the country's largest wind farm and collaborating with Ireland and Denmark to improve its electric power grid. It has also created economic incentives for clean vehicles, including trucks and buses, and tax incentives for energy conservation. Idaho Power, the largest utility in a deeply conservative state, has pledged to produce 100% of its electricity from renewable sources by 2045. The United Kingdom has committed to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. New York, Idaho, and the United Kingdom are creating new, high-paying jobs in the wind and solar energy industries. Natural gas has been portrayed as a bridge to the future. The data now show that it is only a tether to the past. We believe it's time to reject the false promise of gas. Okay, next up, I'd like to conclude the show with an article from The Guardian. World's consumption of materials hits a record 100 billion tons a year. And this is an article I want you to reflect on as we continue to literally consume the planet. Here we go. The amount of material consumed by humanity has passed 100 billion tons every year, a report has revealed. But the proportion being recycled is falling. The climate and wildlife emergencies are driven by the unsustainable extraction of fossil fuels, metals, building materials, and trees. The report's authors warn that treating the world's resources as limitless is leading towards global disaster. The materials used by the global economy have quadrupled since 1970, far faster than the population, which has doubled. In the last 2 years, consumption has jumped by more than 8%, but the reuse of resources has fallen from 9.1% to 8.6%. On average, every person on Earth uses more than 13 tons of material per year. But the report also found that some nations are making steps towards circular economies in which renewable energy underpins systems where waste and pollution are reduced to zero. We risk global disaster if we continue to treat the world's resources as if they are limitless, said Harold Friedel, the chief executive of Circle Economy. Governments must urgently adopt circular economy solutions if we want to achieve a high quality of life for close to 10 billion people by mid-century without destabilizing critical planetary processes. Mark DeWitt, the report's lead author, said, "We are still fueling our growth in population and affluence by the extraction of virgin materials. We can't do this indefinitely. Our hunger for virgin materials needs to be halted." The report found that 100.6 billion tons of materials were consumed in 2017, the latest year for which data is available. Half of the total is sand, clay, gravel, and cement used for building, along with other minerals quarried to produce fertilizer. Coal, oil, and gas make up 15%, and metal ores 10%. The final quarter are the plants and trees used for food and fuel. The lion's share of the materials, 40%, is turned into housing. Other major categories include food, transport, healthcare, communications, and consumer goods such as clothes and furniture. Almost a third of the annual materials remain in use after a year, such as buildings and vehicles, but 15% is emitted directly into the atmosphere as climate heating gases, and nearly a quarter is discarded into the environment, such as plastic in waterways and oceans. A third of the materials is treated as waste, mostly going to landfill and mining spoil heaps. Just 8.6% is recycled. This report sparks an alarm for all governments, said Carolina Schmidt, Chile's environment minister. We need to deploy all the policies to really catalyze this transformation to a circular economy. Christine Close of the conservation group World Wildlife Federation said, the circular economy provides a framework for reducing our impacts, protecting ecosystems, and living within the means of one planet. The report said increasing recycling can make economies more competitive, improve living conditions, and help meet emission targets and avoid deforestation. It reported that 13 European countries have adopted circular economy roadmaps, including France, Germany, and Spain, and that Colombia became the first Latin American country to launch a similar policy in 2019. China's ban on waste imports aims to encourage domestic recycling, the report said, but has also stimulated the development of circular economy strategies in Australia and other countries which previously exported their waste to China. Janez Potocinek, a former European Environmental Commissioner and the co-chair of the UN Environment Program International Resource Panel, said the world needed to learn to do more with less and replace ownership with sharing, as is increasingly being seen with cars. Okay, that does it for today's show, giving you something to think about for the rest of the day and perhaps your life. If you have any questions or comments for me, feel free to email them to me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to review this show, listen to future shows, or listen to any past show that's been published, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.